if white folks were to experience black sadness, it would be too overwhelming for them. Very few whites could take seriously black sadness and still live the lives that they live in.
Anna Deavere Smith heard activist and scholar Cornel West say those words back in 1992 in the aftermath of the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles and incorporated them into her one-woman play, Twilight, Los Angeles, 1992. West would probably say much the same today. Others from Smith's oral history theater technique might have some new things to say. President Obama is part of the oral history in Dallas, where the deaths of five police officers is being commemorated today in an interfaith memorial service in the city. The president speaks to the lives and the loss of officers Thompson, Ahrens, Zamarripa, Smith, and Kroll, along with the lives Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, who were killed before them, and all of the many, many other lives who have been lost in moments of American violence, when American violence is often racial violence. Anna Deavere Smith says this is a unique challenge for this black president, convening the nation in a conversation where there are still some empty seats.
Well, I think the people who tend to be missing from this conversation, both in terms of where you're trying to talk and in the extremes of the events that we just saw happen in Dallas or Orlando, for that matter, or last year at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina, is the psychologists and the psychiatrists, right? And there's not enough talk really about racial bias and what it means that we all have it. You know, that's the soft stuff on that side. How do we get to that? How do we build a moral imagination that defies something that's instinctual in human beings, you know, if we remain as animals? But the fact is we live in very sophisticated societies with very sophisticated technologies and in a global society, and some among us have to get over it, that we don't like the people who are not like us and that we have no empathy for those who are far behind. Some of us have to get over that.
Is it an equivalent corrosion going on in society that someone like Mr. Roof in Charleston can sit and think to himself, well, I'm going to kill black people because I have this need to justify my own unfortunate situation? And then there's a Micah Johnson who has his own feelings of, well, no, I'm going to kill white people because I have my own feelings of unfortunate circumstances related to my military record and that sort of thing. And the availability of guns means that anyone can act out whatever narrative they like.
They can act out whatever narrative they like. And I think that there is a matter of mental illness in both of these stories that you put together. I do think about Mr. Roof when I hear about Mr. Johnson.
And you know what he said? You know what he told the interrogators?
What?
He said, I almost didn't do it because they were so nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
Which means he was responding to empathy right there.
Right there.
Right there.
Right there. Right there. You know, that is isn't that – I've never thought this through, John, so it's dangerous to say it right here. I just like you. See, wonder if there's a kind of a similarity, and I think the similarity has to do with mental illness. But and the fact that we see people in our classrooms coming into our stores, and we pay no attention to behavior that may catch our eye. We just cast that out, too, as something that doesn't have to do with us, right? There is a big difference, isn't there? Because there was no – the people in Mother Emanuel were not players in
right.
any narrative whatsoever. But the police, and I'm certainly not justifying the murder of the police officers, the police are characters in a narrative, in a war, to some people, what some people would call a war. But these people in the basement of Mother Emanuel Church, which I – visited as a part of my research for Notes from the Field doing time in education. These people were sitting in the cool basement of a church in the middle of what was likely a very humid day in South Carolina.
How does empathy and how does not allowing people who we think don't have anything to do with us go off to the corner and have their own angst? How do we prevent a Micah Johnson, for instance, from stewing in that way that he is? How do we say to him, wait, how do we pull him back? How do we pull Mr. Roof back? How do we do that?
It probably doesn't help that Micah Johnson served in the military. You know, it probably doesn't help at all. But that kind of pulling back that you're talking about has to start early. And I think our schools have an opportunity to be a part of that pulling back. You know, empathy is not the soft stuff. It really is the miracle that any of us can care about someone who's very different from us, because our instinct, I suppose, is a survival instinct to stay behind my closed door, behind my, in my fence. So we live in a very secular society. I think, I don't know who said that, you know, the most segregated day in time in America is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. So we have to find, I think, if we're serious about this notion of developing an empathic imagination or a moral imagination, we have to put that in institutions that do exist and build them up so that that can be a serious part of the enterprise.
What do you make of the demands on President Obama's empathy?
Well, I think that, you know, this really points to a very, very important question, John, which is much bigger than President Obama. And that has to do with, what does leadership require right now in these times? I mean, it feels almost impossible to me when you talk about the Bill Reilly's of the world who just over here kind of don't care. I don't know how you stand in a fractured country with so many different concerns and a fractured world for that matter. I just spent quite a bit of time from May until now in Europe. And I mean, you know what's going on there. I mean, I don't know what Obama can do except to continue to announce the need for compassion.
For folks like us who grew up in 1968, who sort of were at the barricades one way or another, is this the America that we wanted, what we have now in 2016, this segregated America? And how did we get
here? It's horrifying. It's horrifying. You know, when I looked this morning just briefly at a couple paragraphs of the Kerner Commission report, 1967, they warn how bad it's going to be, a divided society. We still have it. It's horrifying. I've been going around to these schools in the United States of America and on Indian reservations. The disparity between rich and poor is horrifying. I'm a professor at New York University. I teach excellent students. They inspire me, right? It's horrifying, the path that they've been on and the path of the young people that I'm meeting with potential cutoff, you know, visiting them in juvenile institutions and so forth. But let's not forget, one of the places, again, that we went was South Carolina and met the woman who signed the first petition for desegregation of the schools, which people don't realize is not Brown versus Board of Ed, was Briggs versus Elliott, a small town in South Carolina. What did she fight for? And what did people do in the South when they were forced by the law to make integrated schools? They made their own schools. They made small, private, religious schools so that they didn't have to go to school with black people. And so even though it's the soft stuff, we just can't get around the fact that, what do we do about the fact that we don't like being with one another?
I mean, my kids do not understand why blacks and whites aren't together. Do you think African-American kids the age of my kids have hope, have a sense of this doesn't make any sense, or do they go, are they actually much smarter about all this?
Well, I'm sure there's a statistic that's out already today that we could Google and find out. I don't know. I think it's dangerous to make generalizations. Mm-hmm. I think it's very dangerous to do that. I mean, one of the things I observe on the other side, you know, having for 40 years taught college students, is that I started teaching in 1973. I would say that my students who are graduate students at NYU are more inclined to want to be with people just like them, you know, and these are kids who, you know, had a lot of advantages, even if it wasn't money, it was something else. But they're more inclined to want to be with people who are just like them. And that's what we have to – I call it making the broad jump towards the other. And I if we look back at some of the old texts, Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, where he calls out, you know, Paul Tillich and Martin Buber, philosophers who are really – asking us as humans to make our way away from segregation, to make our way towards seeing every being across from us as a full human being. And we just haven't done that work. We may have put some laws in place, but as I mentioned, we could see how in the matter of desegregation of schools, you can escape those laws. We wish that our country would do something about guns. We'd like economists to come up with some better economic model, But that soft work, that work in the middle of just like
choosing.
Why is it? Choosing where I'm going to be with the people just like me, or am I going to go across, make that bridge across the chasm?
Broad jump to the other.
The broad jump towards the other.
Should be an event in the Olympics.
I think it's a broad jump towards the finish line. And that's the problem. That's the jump we mostly choose, is the broad jump towards the finish line. And there's another horizontal jump that some of us need to make. Not everybody has to make it, but some of us need to be making that jump, that horizontal jump.
Anna Deavere Smith, actress, playwright, and professor at New York University. You know her for her documentary style of plays and theater pieces on race in America. Twilight Los Angeles, 1992, was produced after she arrived in Los Angeles a few weeks after the Rodney King riots. Her new play is called Notes from the Field, about education in the criminal justice system, opening this summer at Harvard, right?
And then at the Second Stage Theater in November in New York City.
Thanks so much, Anna.
Thank you.